You are listening
to the Fly Fishing 97 podcast.
My biggest brown was on a dry cicada, and I went out with this guide and a weekend off of rugby, and I went up in the Lake Moana and the Arnold River. If any of your listeners ever go to New Zealand, they gotta hit the Arnold River. And I'm in the boat, and the guide, he says, put out about 60 feet. So I'm casting around, and I put out like 60 whatever feet, and he's like, okay, bring it in and leave it at your feet, because what we're going to do is we're going to drift the river, and as soon as you see a ring, I need you to put the fly in the ring within 2-3 seconds. Okay, let's try this. And that's how we caught fish. It was, you just would float. You're not randomly searching for these fish. And then there would be a rise, and you would have to react and put your fly in the middle. And when you did, it was 90%, boom, the fish would come back and grab your cicada. And I mean, a cicada on a dry fly,
that's a meal.
It's a pretty easy fly to cast. Hmm. If you have the right setup, it's easy to put it in the hole.
The Fly Fishing 97 podcast is powered by theflycrate.com, an online fly shop. Join the Quarterly Fly Club today, your source for all things fly fishing. And Wait For It Films. For action-packed fly fishing videos and camera-related content, check out Wait For It Films on YouTube or at www.thewaitcreativeco.com. And Broken Tippet Fly Company. Blog and fishing apparel and accessories. Check them out online at brokentippet.com. The Fly Fishing 97 podcast is brought to you by The Fly Crate. The Fly Crate is an online fly shop where you can save more on flies and gear. Shop between hundreds of unique flies and join the Quarterly Fly Club for hand-picked fly assortments for each season. Exclusively for our podcast listeners, you can save an additional 10% on The Fly Crate by using the code FLYFISH97. Go to theflycrate.com and use the code FLYFISH97 at checkout to save 10%.
Welcome to this edition of the Fly Fishing 97 podcast. Super happy you have chosen to join us, and we're going to do what we always do, and that is seek out passionate people in the outdoor space when it comes to the world of tying flies, chasing fins with a fly rod, all that good stuff. We have got Graham O'Rourke on the line today. Now, Graham, originally out of Southern Ontario, now calls Naramata, BC home. There's a lot we can talk about. He's got quite the job in the wine industry in Naramata. At one time was lead viticulturist for Mission Hill Winery, now owner viticulturist at Tightrope Winery in beautiful Naramata, where he and his wife Lindsay run day-to-day operations. And he happens to be an avid fly fisher. And we crossed paths a few times on the ice actually this winter, and a former fishing guide. So we got wine, we got fishing, it's all happening. Graham, thanks for coming on the podcast. I appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks for considering to have me on.
So I always like to start at the beginning, because I know you're originally a Ontario guy. Is that where your passion for fishing started, or walk us through that a little bit?
Oh yeah, absolutely. I grew up in a little town called Corunna, Ontario, and we were on the St. Clair River. Mm-hmm. And my family was lucky enough to have a cottage on an island called Stag Island, which is also in the St. Clair River. So as a kid, you know, we're talking 6, 7, 8 years old, I used to be able to ride my bike from my house through town, get on the ferry and be at my cottage. And it was all about going fishing all the time. There's about 100 cottages on the island, and everyone had a dock. Every dock had perch at the end of the dock. So I used to dock run constantly, catching fish and bringing them home as a youngster. And I learned at a very young age how to fillet perch, because dad wouldn't do it unless they were 10, 11 inches. And
That's an art, filleting.
Yeah, little fish. It's the hardest thing is fillet a little fish.
Yeah, for sure. So what else, what other kind of species were in those lakes when you're talking about dock hopping?
Yeah, we had perch, we had all the little guys, all the court, like the sunfish and the crappie and whatnot. But walleye were the trophy. So we would go out at night on the end of the dock and jig for, well, jig in the current, right? So it's a little different than what we would consider jigging for kokanee on the ice, but jigging in the current for walleye. And then we had northern pike, we had muskie, we had, because Lake Huron was close by, so we would get chinook, we'd get coho, we'd get rainbows, we'd get brown, we like splake. We would pretty much get everything. But as a kid, worms, minnows, it was all about the walleye and the perch. There was a small smallmouth bass population. And that's one thing about Ontario that people don't realize is you go into a body of water and there's everything in that body.
You don't know what you're going to catch. I love it.
Yeah.
We got a few lakes like that around here, as you know, and we'll get to some of those. But how did you kind of come to find fly fishing? Like, do you remember when specifically fly fishing first showed up for you?
100%. So I moved out west in 93 after finishing university, and I took a job at BC Parks up at Manning Park, and I was working with a guy, and he was fly fishing, and so I would have been about 22 or 23 years old, and we went to the Lightning Lakes, these tiny little lakes up there at Manning Park, and the fish are really small, but they wouldn't touch what I was offering to them, and he was catching them one after the other after the other. And he's like, yeah, you're fishing for trout. You need to use a fly. You need to use a fly rod and a fly. So I went down and saw a bit of an icon here in British Columbia. I went and saw David Steele out at High Water Tackle.
Okay.
And I walked in there and I said, everything. I need everything. Like, what do I need to fly fish in this province? He sold me a rod, Sage DS2, and I still use it. You know, they don't even make them anymore. Couple of reels, couple of lines. He gave me a box full of flies. He gave me the Gilly.
Oh, that's a good one. That's a good book.
He's like, read this.
Yeah.
I bought that day. I spent every penny I had. Belly boat, waders, fins. Like, I'm talking. I walked out of there thinking this better be good because I have no more money. I don't know how I was going to get back to Manning Park.
That's funny. Well, you know what? Manning Park would be a perfect spot to kind of feed that, right? I mean, you got the Similkameen, you got all the little kind of alpine lakes. It's a great place to learn.
And the fish are hungry.
Yeah.
So lucky enough, I'm fishing lakes. They're smaller fish, but the fish were hungry. So I was immediately hooked. And I worked on my cast. I read that book about 3 times. And then I started buying different books by Morris and Jan.
Sure.
Started buying, you know, the fly tying material and the vice, and just whenever I get into something, I don't get into much, but when I get into it, I'm in.
I'm like that.
Like I tell my kids right now, you're either all in or you're all out.
Yeah. It's a problem. Trust me. So, ask my wife. It's like when, anyway, it's, you know what though? I think that's not a bad thing. Like if you love it, and it kind of, I do that with a few things, but fly fishing in particular is the one thing that just has never gone away.
Yeah. It can be very satisfying.
Yeah.
It could also be very frustrating.
Oh yeah.
You know, when you know you're at a lake where you've done really well and you're not getting anything.
Yeah.
You know, they're there. I just went through this on Vaso just Sunday, 2 days ago.
Yeah. Just so like, you're printing fish, but nothing's
going on.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like, why aren't they touching what I have?
Hmm.
And you try everything. Being an Ontario guy, I'm not exclusive to fly fishing. I know this is a fly fishing thing, but I will fish any method, any gear, anything to actually get the fish.
Yeah. No, I get that.
Yeah.
I think too, one thing I really think, Graham, is fly fishers, like patterns, they've come a lot from the minnow guys, right? So from like the Bass Pros and all that back in the day, all these minnows got segmented and fancy. And I look at some of the flies that people are tying now, not just insect related, but when you start looking at bait fish patterns, I mean, we draw a lot, I think, from that genre.
Oh, for sure. Well, there are certain flies that sometimes it's just better to buy what they're doing.
Yeah.
Yeah. Right. Like we were on the Snoqualmie 2 weekends ago and took a while, but I finally figured out that the rainbows, and there's not a lot in there, but the rainbows they wanted stoneflies.
Hmm.
So then, you know, we used what I had, and, you know, fishing the Snoqualmie can be tough because with a 15-year-old, because there's trees behind you, you know, so we hung a few up, but, I went to see Nick and Savas up at Trout Waters and was looking for stoneflies and specifically looking for the material to buy stoneflies. And it was actually Nick that said, look, just buy them. Like,
yeah.
He's like, you have spent hundreds of dollars in here on material. And Garen, my son, loves tying flies. I'll tie flies. We sit together and we tie flies and we compare them together. You know, I'm not tying stoneflies. And he's like, just buy a few.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I'm like, you know,
all this material.
I'm like that with some deer hair patterns, and there's certain dries. It's just like, oh man, I just can't commit the time it takes to learn every single pattern, you know? So it must
that's
be
Gomphus bug for me.
Yeah, no, me too. That's exactly like, what, oh deer hair.
I don't know how many times I've, you know, as a hunter, I have got deer hair galore, but what I don't have is vacuum bags galore.
Yeah, it's a bit of a mess, isn't it?
Oh my God.
Yeah, I'm with you. It must be kind of special to fish with your son as much as you do, because I know he's probably inherited some of that passion, and I see you guys are out there a lot.
We're out there every chance that we get. It is nice. It's great watching him enjoy catching fish. And as an ex-guide, and I've told him, because I know that's kind of a could be a way he ends up, you have to enjoy watching someone else catch a fish as much as you enjoy catching a fish. Like mm-hmm. when you're watching somebody fight an incredible fish, you know what they're going through.
Yeah.
Right? Like you do. And you still get that exhilarating feeling of, are they going to land it? You know, is this going to happen? Are we going to get a picture of this? Like, mm-hmm. What fish is it? First of all, like depending on where you're fishing, you don't actually know what it is for a bit. Yeah. And yeah, he just loves it. He can, and he's learned over the last couple of years in maturing where we can go out and fish all day, and if he happens to get skunked, he's not disappointed. It's not a quiet ride mm-hmm. on the way home.
Yeah.
Right. And early on, you know, there was a few quiet rides coming home. Right. Like the first time I took him to Sawmill, I bragged about Sawmill. And then I took him, and for whatever reason, it didn't happen. And he was like, I'm never going back there. But we went back, and sure enough, we had a good day, and he learned what Sawmill could be.
Well, that's a trophy lake for those that don't know it in our area, and it can be pretty tough, because it's those catch and release lakes, as much as we think the fish should be easy to catch, they get smart, right? They know a thing or two once they've been caught.
Right. There's certain times of the year where they just shut down.
Yeah. No, for sure. So you just alluded to kind of a quiet trip home. But so how about a trip when you're headed to the lake with Garen or whoever you're heading out with? I always like to go down this kind of set the scene for us. What's playing in the truck? Like what's playing in the stereo en route?
Well, I'm an Ontario guy, so a lot of classic rock, a lot of Bob Seger, a little Tom Petty.
Nice.
Tragically Hip, of course, being in Ontario when they were university age and they were hitting it. Yeah. I'm a farmer first and foremost, so country comes on from time to time. But nowadays the country is, you never know if you're getting a pop star who was told he's a country singer, so it's kind of hard to figure that out, but for the most part it's classic rock.
Yeah,
you know,
right on. One go-to fly pattern, Graham, so if there's one pattern kind of for the still waters that you're hitting that you use more often than not, what would that be?
Oh wow,
I know it's a big question.
Yeah. I'm a fan of the almost every lake around here has dragonflies.
Yeah.
So, and dragonflies being that they're in the water for 4 years before they fly away.
Mm-hmm.
They're a food source for the most part. open water, they're a food source. So I will use a dragon to search a lake, especially if I'm with someone else. Because I know they're using something totally different.
What I love about fish and dragon patterns, whether it's Darner's, Gomphus, the way they hit, like, you know, they're not messing around.
Well, you know, every now and again, you do get that one where you're like, did I just...
Yeah.
Like, they slurp it up. It's kind of like a bass.
Is that bottom?
A lot of times.
Yeah.
Yeah, like a bass. When you're fishing for bass, sometimes they just kind of put it in their mouth.
Yeah. Yeah.
They don't hammer it. But I find with especially the gumphus, they will sometimes just pick it up off the bottom, and you got to watch your line as it's going in the water.
Yeah.
Where it just starts to stand up. It's kind of like fishing for a bull trout on a river system where, you know, you don't feel the hit so much as your line does something weird.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. I've had that happen many times with bass. You cast out and all of a sudden your line just starts moving one way.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. You just set the opposite, and sure enough,
yeah,
there it is. And those are the big ones.
Where's your
same
favorite
trout?
Yeah. Yeah. No, for sure. Amen. Where's your favorite place to kind of get your fly fishing fix, Graham, when you're not out there? So, like you alluded to trout waters, is there a shop? Is it social media? Like, where do you get your fix when you're not on the water?
Oh, it's not fair to say I'm constantly trolling other people's fish porn, whether it's Instagram or even some of the Facebook stuff. Once you filter through all the,
yeah,
you know, the certain people, but no, like Instagram, you see some of the fish and you see some of the pictures and you just get so jealous. You know, I was lucky enough to spend a couple of years in New Zealand and fish over there. And I do have a few pictures of some fish that I managed to get to a net that you just take a second to realize what's just happened and beauty. Like the fish are just hard to catch and gorgeous when you get them to the net.
You get into any browns when you're down there?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, I'll send you a picture or two. Some
love it.
My biggest brown was on a dry cicada, and I went out with this guide and a weekend off of rugby, and I went up in the Lake Moana and the Arnold River. If any of your listeners ever go to New Zealand, they gotta hit the Arnold River. And I'm in the boat, and the guide, he says, put out about 60 feet. So I'm casting around, and I put out like 60 whatever feet, and he's like, okay, bring it in and leave it at your feet, because what we're going to do is we're going to drift the river, and as soon as you see a ring, I need you to put the fly in the ring within 2-3 seconds. I'm like, okay, I mean, let's try this. And that's how we caught fish. It was, you just would float, 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 float. You're not randomly searching for these fish, and then there would be a rise and you would have to react and put your fly in the middle. And when you did, it was 90%, boom, the fish would come back and grab your cicada. And I mean, a cicada on a dry fly,
that's a meal.
It's a pretty easy fly to cast. If you have the right setup, it's easy to put it in the hole, and you put it in the hole, and sure enough, and I've caught some fish that were like 25, 6, 7 inches, just gorgeous colors.
You know, it's a cicada year this year.
It's, I've been watching the news. Yeah.
Yeah. Crazy. Well, that's a meal for fish, you know, and I'm seeing some of these patterns. I don't know I'm sure you follow some of them on Instagram. It's like, holy mackerel. There's like 10 different colors of deer hair spun and clipped and just crazy good. So
you get it right, you get it right, right? When you figured it out.
Yeah. That sounds amazing. That's on my bucket list for sure. So you said you're playing rugby down there. I always like to do a deep dive into sports. Like, I know you're also a big hockey guy, or I know you had some kids in hockey.
Yeah, kids in hockey. I never played hockey.
Well, tell me about your rugby background. Where did you play rugby?
I started in high school as a venting exercise for extra energy. And then ended up playing at university when I was going to university in Windsor, and just continued the game. It's one of those games, people ask a lot about rugby. It's one of those games you either play one game or you play 1,000 games, like you just, or you play forever. Right. It's an excellent game. It's, you know, gentleman's game.
Yeah.
It seems pretty violent to those that don't, you know, understand what's going on. And it can be, but for the most part, we're respectful individuals that we're trying to win, but we're not trying to hurt each other. Whereas hockey, you know, it's kind of like a hurt each other mentality, no matter what.
Win or lose.
And sometimes when you're losing in hockey, like I watched my son play hockey forever. He still plays hockey. He's down in Missouri playing hockey for college. And I don't understand the game. There's two refs, two linesmen, 10 players. With rugby, there was 30 of us on the field and only one ref. And we're way more respectful.
A lot less shifts too. Right. You just don't stop.
When I started back as a teenager, you couldn't go off unless you couldn't walk.
Yeah.
Right. Whereas now the games, they're trying to make the game a little safer, which is kudos. You know, it's more entertaining to watch now. It's faster.
Yeah.
But, you know, guys are shifting off just because it's been 55 minutes or 60 minutes or whatever.
It's a lot of running.
Makes the game faster.
So what if you're cheering for your team, who's your team? Like, who do you follow, even whether it's football, hockey, you know, soccer, baseball, rugby?
Well, I'm a Detroit fan first and foremost.
Right.
So we've got baseball, football, basketball, hockey. So that's my town. Being a small town Ontario kid, most Ontario kids either went for Toronto or Detroit. I was a Detroit kid. My dad took me to a few games, especially when the Bad Boys, the Pistons, were coming up in the late 80s. And, you know, so we were Detroit people. So I'm a Detroit fan. Rugby, I would have to say, having played in New Zealand, I will watch the All Blacks whenever they play.
Yeah.
But I also have a small place in my heart for the Welsh, the Welsh rugby boys.
Did you not have... I don't know if I'm misremembering this, but didn't you have tickets to the one home playoff game that Detroit had?
Oh, my God. What? I did. You know what I did? And the flight out of Kelowna got canceled.
Oh, shoot.
Yeah. No, that was, you know, we were 20 years waiting for a playoff game. And I have a couple of friends back from Sarnia, Ontario, and they had the one was willing to give me the second ticket. And I booked the hotel and had the Airbnb. Yeah, that was heartbreaking.
They had a great year, though. They looked good.
They did look good. And it was just a couple of tough... I mean, it's professional sports, no matter what sport it is, no matter what was going on or level of game, whether it's a league game or a playoff game. It's just a game of inches, right? And it was just a couple games, a couple moves. Goff hit the receiver didn't get it, and then... Yeah, just the way it went. The fluke was a bounce off of the defender's face mask that happened to be picked up by the San Francisco player on the 2-yard line, and he went in. Had that not happened, that game was over. But, you know, like, luckily for the rest of the league, Detroit is on the GOAT end. And I don't mean greatest ever. I mean the other end of the GOAT. Highlight reel films, right? Like 64-yard field goal with no time on the clock, game's over, Green Bay wins. Aaron Rodgers throwing a Hail Mary from nowhere.
Yeah.
There's one Packer and six Lions, and the Packer gets it. Like, there's all these scenarios guys like me remember about the, you know, the no-look three-pointer that Larry Bird hit, where there's no way he knew where the net was and it went in to get the Pistons out of the playoffs. Like, there's all these hockey, like there's so many hockey off the shin pad, off a crossbar, down off the back of the goalie's leg, and in, like, just in overtime.
You guys had a pretty good run in hockey, though. I mean, with the Yzerman days.
We still hold a record for most consecutive playoff appearances.
Yeah.
Although they're not making it again this year.
Huh.
We had a run, but, you know, with the Lions or with the Red Wings, they gave away Bertuzzi. And that was a mistake. They sent him to Toronto, which really hurts, right? And that's one thing about Detroit. We get players that, you know, as a fan, you feel like they're in their prime, and then upper management sends them away.
Yeah.
Frustrating.
Yeah. I get it. I like talking careers on this. So obviously I know you're a proud farmer. You put a lot of work into your farm, your vineyards. Are you doing the best gig you've had so far, Graham? Farming the vines and whatnot. Are you in your happy spot?
I feel like 100%. Like the farming lifestyle doesn't offer you a lot of financial rewards, but it definitely offers you time to live the lifestyle you want to live, right? So, you know, yeah, we're dealing with Mother Nature, and she can be tough, and she can slap you in the face, but the farming lifestyle is where I need to be. I have a commerce degree at university. That's what I studied at university. My first job was with BC Parks in administration, but I very quickly realized that being inside when it was not where I needed to be. A lot of my summer jobs growing up were out in the farms in southwestern Ontario, whether it be soya or corn to tasseling or tomatoes or whatever. But definitely now, and I've been here since, I guess I was about 35 or 36. It is very rewarding, and you can organize your week or your day or your hour to get in the little bits and pieces that you want to get in, whether it's, you know, scouting for deer or checking out a new lake. You know, you definitely get offered the time. Now, when it's busy, you're busy and you can't get away.
Yeah.
But also, if there's nothing happening on the farm, there's no excuse weather-wise to get out and have a good time.
Yeah, I love it.
I do like farming. It's fun.
Let's flip the coin. Is there anything you've done in your career that you're like, you kind of said you don't really want an office job, sounds like, but is there anything that you've specifically done that you're like, man, I'm never doing that again?
Oh, for sure. Roofing.
Oh, yeah.
That's a summer job. That was terrible. But actually, you know what? No. Just that. I had a few jobs here and there.
Yeah.
You know, obviously we have days that you don't want to repeat, but they're not prolonged events where you intentionally put yourself over and over again in that same scenario. I've always been a pretty selfish person. So when I get into a job that I don't like, I don't spend much time there. When I quickly realize that this isn't for me and I get out. I had a very short stint with the bank after the commerce degree, and I quickly realized, you know, you're looking around the office, you're like, I don't want to be that guy in 20 years. He's still here. So I was, again, it's a lot of it is more of a selfish approach. You know, I'm doing this for me. You only got one.
Yeah, you know, we're what? All,
none of us are getting out of this alive. So
yeah. And if you find something you enjoy, I mean, it's just so, it's so much better, right?
Yeah, I've had my time skiing and ski touring, and I've had my time as a mountain biker, and that was fun. But I always seem to come back to the quieter, slower times when it comes to fishing. And now, new passion that's maybe like 12 or 13, 14 years old for the hunting side of life.
What do you think that fly fishing brings into your world? So if you kind of look at, like, you know, why do you think you spend all this time? You know, you've been doing it a lot of years, made a living at it for some time, but it's still a huge part of your life. What does it do for you?
Well, it's calming. No. It's just, I enjoy it. It's hard to explain, but you just, someone that has the passion and the desire to be out there, like there's days when you don't even think about what you're going to do tomorrow. If there's an open half a day, you're just going to grab your gear and go explore, go find something to go try and find a lake. Like, what are they eating in April? What are they eating in June? What are they taking in August? you know, because they're changing their diet constantly, and it's a challenge to figure it out. And it's calming for me because fly fishing is slow. You know, sure, if you're on the Birkenhead River out of Tamberden, it can be a little quicker. There's your spot. You got to move. You got to fight through the bush. You got to follow the river. Same with the sort of upper Lillooet kind of areas. You're constantly moving. But with your stillwater fishing on a lake, they're there. And it's up to you to figure out what they want. There's no sense in moving. Mm-hmm. You know, you can move across a lake. You can move 50 meters or 100 meters, find the depth. But, you know, I just find it, it's nice and slow, calming, relieving, yeah. Satisfying. You know, like the tug is the drug, right? Like, let's be honest. It's, you know, especially as a catch and release fisherman, they're just the challenge of what do they want and getting it.
I was driving back roads home like I always do because I hate the highway. But I the balsam root sunflowers that are out now, and now the Saskatoons are going. So I know those mayflies are coming and those crannies are coming, right? It's like happening probably in the next couple of weeks here.
But, oh, for sure. Like when you first hit a lake and you see, I remember one summer being up on Vincent Lake back, I don't know, like 15 years ago, and I'd never been to the lake. And I get up there, I finally find it, you know, guy in Whistler, Brian Niska, he's like, when you're moving to the Okanagan, right? I said, yeah, I'm moving to the Okanagan. He's like, you got to go get it. Like, this is, we're talking 2003.
Mm-hmm. The glory days.
Never been there. I roll it on the lake and there were thousands of damsels skirting across the top of the lake. I'm like, well, I guess I know what I'm putting on. And sure enough, it was one of the first days, but just one of the greatest days ever. Those are the days you remember, right? Like when it's just laid out for you. Here's what you're using. Look at them all.
Yeah, like a big caddis hatch or something.
Too. Yeah. Although, you know, and like now when you show out on a lake, there's nothing happening. You're like, okay, now what am I going to do?
Yeah. Put on that search and dragon and cover some water or something.
Leech your dragon and just, you know, super slow. We have a lot of options. We have a John boat that we fish out of. We have little fishing kayaks that we take, and we also have belly boats. So we have options of how to. Yeah. I prefer a belly boat on a small lake.
Yeah. Yeah, I get that. I've only recently, last maybe 4 years, been fishing out of those new kind of prams, those wider. I got a Journey. But we fish pontoon boats like Skadden's or Outcast for years, and there's something appealing about that too, right? It's just different, but simple.
Yeah, I have a Fishcat 4.
Yeah,
I love it for certain lakes, right? Like you get caught on the wrong side of a lake and the wind picks up, you're pulling a hamstring trying to get back. Oh, yeah. But for the most part, I really enjoy just quietness of fishing out of the Fishcat.
Let's talk about your passion for farming in the wine industry and specifically tightrope. So, you know, this winery that you and your partner Lindsay started, walk us through that a little bit. When did, because I know you were working for the big company for Mission Hill for a few years, and then it seemed like you kind of found your vineyard and kind of just focused in on that. But tell us
about that. We had the vineyard. We came here for the first time in 2003.
Yeah.
Just to have a look at the Okanagan and to kind of peek around and see what everyone was talking about. And I worked at Pinot Reach, which is now Tantalus.
Okay.
I spent a little time there. I took the course at the college. And then, you know, the more I got into it, it's kind of like fly fishing. The more I got into it, the more I got hooked, the more I realized there's more to it than just sitting on a tractor and running diesel through a machine and dragging this mower around. Like, there's some science in there. There's some strategy. Mm-hmm. And then that's when we went back over. We went over to New Zealand. Lindsay took the bachelor program. I worked for a year and got involved in the rugby team. And the second year, got talked into doing the graduate program, and the more I learned that there's a proper way to do it. There's a science involved, matching the science to the season kind of idea. I just it was a challenge.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess got into it. And then when we came back here, I worked with Tom DeBello at Cedar Creek.
Oh yeah.
And then happened to do harvest in the winery, and making wine the way Tom wanted to make wine.
Yep.
Quickly realized that I want to do this. We want to do this ourselves. We want to be in charge. But we bought a piece of land. We bought a small orchard in Penticton on the Naramata Bench. And I was lucky enough, John, I was interviewing with Howard Soon for a winemaking position. And I was interviewing with John Symes for a viticulture position. And John was quicker to get back to me. And I really enjoyed the interview with John. I liked this passion. He was obviously from New Zealand, so we sidetracked a bit on different conversations, and got that job. I managed a seat on the viticulture team, and then just spent six seasons with them, running sort of three quarters of the Mission Hill stuff, and started to match the books. Right, so farming is a practical side. You get the grandpas and the old school farmers that this is the way you do it. And with viticulture, there's some science attached to it.
Mm-hmm.
So I was able to take this match, the practical side, and some of the old school guys that were, you know, I grew up in Oliver and Seuss on their dad's orchard.
Yep.
And started to sort of massage what they were doing and bring the science out of it. And luckily Mission Hill has umpteen tiers of wine, right? Like they've got 20 different tiers of wine. So and the whole idea back in 06, 7, 8, 9, all the way to 12 was to run the budget towards the tier. So I was able to match that. And then here on the home property, I was just selling the fruit. So we planted in 07. So 2009, 10, 11, we were selling fruit. Lindsay was making wine. Oh geez, she was making wine for Black Widow and Laughing Stock and Cedar Creek, and she ended up at Ruby Blues, which at the time was Ruby Tuesdays, but they got sued by that restaurant chain down in the States because they sell alcohol, and Ruby Tuesdays was making alcohol. It was kind of childish, but anyway, they ended up being Ruby Blues. And we just always knew from the 2007 and 8 that at some point we were going to start Tightrope. So we tossed names back and forth. You know, what is it? What is the wine industry? And honestly, in the vineyard and in the winery and in life, especially when you have children, it's about balance.
Mm-hmm.
It's about finding that balance and staying true to a direction, especially when you're raising kids. Like as parents, you both need to be on the same page, you know, on certain times of discipline and whatnot. Like,
yeah, that's fair.
None of this, I'm going to go to mom and I'm going to go to dad. Like everyone's got to be on the same page. But with vineyards, it's the same. Like I know what kind of wine Lindsay wants to make. I know what kind of wine she wants to put in the bottle. So I grow it that way. Like,
cool.
There's a lot of things you can do in a vineyard to manipulate the wine, right?
Oh,
as a winemaker, I know you're going to not be happy, but the wine's made outside.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. It's I've worked with lots of different vineyards. What is the name of your home farm?
Glanlyn Vineyard, and it's in Welsh, it means lakeside.
Okay. I thought I saw something about Fleet Road. Was that?
Well, that's the road that it's on.
Okay.
But we started it as Glanlyn Vineyards.
It's funny. Years ago, I worked with some Pinot Noir from there when I was at Road 13.
Road 13, that's right.
We just called it Fleet Road Pinot. Yeah. Was that you?
Yeah, that was here. That was this property, JM.
Really? Yeah.
Yeah, that was this. That's 2011.
Funny. That's hilarious.
2011. That was here, and I remember telling JM the next year that we were going to start the winery, and he wasn't going to get any fruit anymore. And boy, he was very French in his approach. He was a little upset, but yeah,
he has a lot of passion.
That was a great wine. I remember going out and finding a case of it at one of the beer and wine stores and taking it
Well, we were making like 4 or 5 different Pinots from different lots. And I just remember that being one of them. I didn't realize it was you guys. That's really cool.
No, it was us. And it was JM Wild Fermented, that Pinot.
Yeah.
And I remember I was still across the road at Mission Hill. And I came over and did punch downs a couple times just to smell it.
Yep.
And I remember telling Lindsay, like, after punching those wines down, that this is what it's on. And so we've continued JM's winemaking philosophy on Fleet Road Pinot. We still do a Fleet Road Pinot.
That's cool.
It's still wild ferment.
Yeah, he I don't know if you know this about me, but I worked with him in 2004 at Sumac Ridge, and I learned so much that I wanted to go, when he came back from Hidden Bench, I wanted to go work with him, and because thought he'd be somebody really good to kind of learn from, and he definitely was that, for sure.
For good. That wine was good.
Yeah, yeah, lots of wild ferments, which sometimes doesn't always go well, but
yes.
it's a bit of a dance.
100%.
It's a dance.
100%. If the vineyard is clean and the fruit is clean, a wild ferment is easier, but if you get a bit dirty out there, then yeah, it can go sideways in a hurry.
Yeah.
And I mean, luckily for us, with Lindsay and I, we're doing the punch down. So if I get down there at, you know, in November and I'm doing a punch down mid ferment and it gets a little funky, Lindsay can go and it's cleaned up right away. So
yeah,
these things happen. It's nice to be able to be on site. Like, the winery is 65 yards away from the house. We're very hands-on.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, Lindsay's the winemaker, so she's making the wine. She's 100% in.
Yeah.
And if I've got fruit, and I've had fruit a few times, like we've had some 2014 and 2016, we've had some pretty wet harvests. So you know what that means. And
yeah,
you know, it's like, hey, we're doing our best out here to give you the cleanest fruit possible, but you might want to, you know, carry that strategy onward.
Yeah, no, for sure. And, you know, yeah. Think about, Graham, all the challenges, like, especially in the last 3, 4, 5 years, it's been like, what next, right?
Yeah.
You know, from cold snaps to fires to, but I mean, to me, that's what I love about it, is you got to adapt or die. You know what I mean? It's like, if you got to figure it out.
Well, you got to pay attention.
Yeah.
And not just like, as a winemaker, you're not just tuning in on September 15th. You're there. Like, when was bud break? Let's see flowering. Like, when, when is everything happening? How's the season? You got to pay attention all the time. Same with the farming side of it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm one of the things I love to see is the ferment. I want to smell the ferment.
Oh,
I want to be in the winery during harvest. And now I say that, I do it,
you know,
later at night when I'm home from walking around in the bush, but I still go down and see what's going on.
I think what a lot of people don't realize, not to get all geeky on the wine stuff, because trust me, I can jump down rabbit holes, but you know, when you're swirling wine in a glass and you get the nose of it, for instance, and then you go to the tank and there's 10,000 liters of it fermenting, it is like that times 10,000. You know what I mean? Like, the aromatics are so powerful. That's what I like to write tasting notes, actually, when they're fermenting, especially with whites, because you really get some interesting nuances that, you know.
Oh, but for sure. Smelling a white ferment, I mean, obviously there's times when it's a bit aspirin-y kind of thing, but there's when you get that like tropical banana hits you in the face on a white, especially like a Riesling or something, you're just like, oh yeah.
Yeah,
same with a red. Like, after you've fermented it, you put it in the tank and you're letting it settle before it goes to barrel, and then you drain the tank into the barrels, and then you smell that tank of red that it's just solids.
Yeah.
You get a really good indication of what that wine's going to be like at that point.
Yeah, absolutely. Right. What's your biggest challenge when it comes to the farming? Is, you know, like, is it working with certain varieties? Is it certain seasons? Like, what's your biggest challenge these days?
Well, these days, I mean, after the winter we've just had, it's just the stress, the anticipation of seeing how bud break, what kind of consistency of bud break is going to happen. We grow about 12 different varieties. We have 3 different properties, And they're all on an Aromata bench in Penticton, but with all the different varieties, it's just the different timings of bud break and the different pruning strategies. Like, so Pinot Noir is a great example. We have some areas of our Pinot Noir that is just for rosé. So I prune it different, I water it different, you know, the nutrients are different. The whole approach is different when it comes to shoot canopy management and leaf pulling and all that. So, you know, just trying to keep up to the season. We have a really short season, and it's a really, things grow super fast once the heat comes on.
Yeah.
And it really is just keeping up, which I enjoy. I mean, I know what I'm doing every day. Mm-hmm. I know what I've got to do. I do all the tractor work, and I bring people in to do the handwork. But I've got a pretty good group of people that have been doing the handwork for me for a bunch of years. Like 25 acres, I can't do it all. And letting that go in the beginning was a challenge.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when it was just the home property, I could do it all. I knew how it was getting done. But that it's other people, it can be a little bit more stressful.
Do you and Lindsay spend time in the shop too? I mean, talking to customers, like hand selling the wine as well, or do you just have kind of like wine shop staff? What does that look like?
We do have wine shop staff. We have a really good general manager in Colin, and then a wine shop, wine club manager in Andrea Jittler, who is an Italian wine scholar, very passionate about wine and has been with us from the beginning and super dedicated to us. She's the wine club members, you know, we're just going through wine club right now. She calls them, they remember her, she remembers them.
Mm-hmm.
Like the personal side of it is just excellent. Being small with only, you know, 450 wine club members, it affords you that sort of connection. But, you know, there are times when I will go to the shop and say hi to people, but it's not my focus for sure. I am the farmer. Lindsay is the winemaker, but she does do more time than I do in the shop.
Yeah, fair.
Right. You do have to have that connection.
Oh, from, it's so,
you know, at certain times. It's if important. I know someone's coming,
yeah,
then I will try my hardest to be in the shop.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, I've missed a few people because I've been fishing, but they understand.
I think it's really cool though, because there's not many wineries. If you go visit wine country, you get to talk to the winemaker, the viticulturist, the farmer. You know, you're not just talking to somebody that's learned about these wines and can talk to these wines. You grew the wines, you fermented the wines, you know everything about it. So for me, that's a pretty special relationship.
Yeah. Depends what I've been doing. Like, you know, if I've been outside in the field and it's sweaty and hot and smell like a dog that's been dead in the desert for a week, I don't go in the shop, but Lindsay's usually downstairs, and wherever Lindsay goes, the dogs go. So, you know, when Lindsay comes in, you got Lindsay, the winemaker, you got her, the farm dogs, they're all around. And people tend to really like that more than, you know, my last trip in the shop, I had a hydraulic pump go on my Landini. So I was going in there to get towels because I couldn't find towels to wipe my hands. I was covered in hydraulic fluid and angry, because if you ever work on a tractor, pieces are tight.
Yeah.
You know, you get dirty and you're angry because you're dirty and you've stubbed your, you know, you bumped your head twice. And as a bald guy, when I smack my head, everyone sees it. They're like, oh, what did you do? I don't have a hair to hide the bruise on my head. So
missing a little bit of skin on the knuckles.
Oh my
right?
God, so many times. Yeah. I do like it. It's there's a sense of satisfaction when you can fix your own equipment.
Yeah.
But you don't come out of there without a cut of some sort.
Yeah. Well, let's take it back to the water, Graham. So
sure.
If you're just dialing us in, we've got Graham O'Rourke on the line. He's originally from Southern Ontario, calls Naramata Bench in British Columbia home, lead viticulturist and owner, proprietor at Tightrope, along with his wife, Lindsay, who's the winemaker there. Graham's an avid fly fisher. He's out there all the time, did some guiding I know you're a big hunter. I like to talk stories. Like, for me, outdoor stories. Like, have you had anything weird or wonderful happen to you in your time on the water that you just kind of went, man, that was a trip? Or, you know, like a wildlife encounter?
Yeah, the first. Anytime you have a first of any event is crazy. I've had fish in the Birkenhead River. I've had black bears pop out of the bush like 4 or 5 feet from me. We're both scared at the same time. We run in different directions. You know, the first time you catch a rainbow and a loon grabs a hold of it.
Oh, yeah.
You know, those experiences, you're just like, what? What happened? Like, I just had a 12-inch rainbow and now I've got a 8 or 10 or whatever pound loon on the end. And I still want that fish, right? One of my trips up there, I caught a fish and then I caught a loon. And then I got the fish in from the loon. And then I fed the fish to the loon and I was fishing. And about 10 feet behind me, I heard the splash of a lifetime. Like, at the time, I had no idea what it was. I might have crapped myself. I turn around and there was a bald eagle flying away with the fish. And I thought, holy shit, that's crazy. So I, you know, as an observer, I just sat there and watched this bald eagle fly up in the tree. Didn't even eat the fish. He just sat there with it. And the loon underneath was just doing circles, creating a whirlpool, making a whole whack of noise. You know, and I have a fishing experience in Ontario where we're fishing and we watch this moose come out of the water, get in the water and swim across right out in front of us to the other side of the lake. Like, all these sort of first time you see it, you think, oh my God, this is why at the time you don't think this is why I'm doing it. But then you look back and you think back and you're like, yeah, this is awesome. Like fishing in Hawaii, bringing in a trevally and then a shark grabs onto it. You're just like, what the fuck is going on? Like, this is awesome. And yeah, those kind of experiences, you know, those are the good experiences, as opposed to being at the other end of a lake in a kayak and then you start getting hailed on in June in the Okanagan. Like, that can be pretty, those are the ones you want to, just got to put your head down. Right? Those happen.
Humbling. Yeah.
Yeah.
You just said something, Graham, that, speaks to, I think, what a lot of us do out there. And that's the observation, right? You know, you're on the water, you're seeing what bugs are hatching, you're seeing what's in the shore, you're paying attention to the swallows working a corner, a patch of crannies over in a weed bed. And you know what I mean? Like, those subtle things where sometimes you don't think you're working, but you're working. You know what I mean? You're just kind of observing, you're taking it all in, and then you start building that picture on where to go and what to use. And I think that's something as fly fishers that we all enjoy.
Yeah. All of it. Watching an osprey come out of the sky and smash the lake.
Yeah.
You know, I've been on the Lillooet River fishing, not getting anything. There's no fish here. And then had an osprey smash the water 40 yards from me and fly away which was probably like a 15, 16 inch dolly. Or a bull trout. You're just like, okay, I just went through there with, I know they want what I've got. They didn't touch it. And then the bird comes down, smashes and flies away. But you still, you know, you shake your fist at the bird, but you think, good for him. Like, he's got it. And that's why you do it.
Yeah.
You know,
paint us a picture. Your perfect day. So, you know, what kind of water are you heading out there with? Garen, your son, or, you know, who are you fishing with? Is there something cold to drink, or, you know, at the end of the day, what does that look like?
For me, one of my favorite places to fish, and I'll probably get killed for this, but the Upper Lillooet right now.
I might edit that name. I might edit that, but
anyway. The Upper Lillooet River, like north of sort of, I guess it'd be west of Pemberton.
Yeah.
Starting at sort of the Hurley turnoff and then floating back towards Pemberton. Right now, the Sea Run cutthroats will be in there. and just Mickey Finn, because they're chasing Fry.
Right.
By yourself, right? Got the whole river system to yourself, no one around, and just swinging flies through the seams, and then putting on a big articulated leech and hitting the ends and the deeper pools for the bull trout that you know they're hanging out in there.
Oh, yeah.
To catch the cutthroat offside. That would be number one for me. I lived in that area for about 10 years and guided on it and, you know, like fishing those mature bulls in that system with that scenery of Mount Curry in the background was just incredible. Never a bad day.
Love it.
Yeah, just gorgeous, gorgeous area, gorgeous valley, the whole Pemberton Valley to fish, even if you're not catching a ton of fish. When you get a fish, you know it's a mature fish, and it's the scenery is incredible. The river changes all the time with every spring push out and every spring flush. That river is different, both the Birkenhead and the Lillooet. You know, like anyone that says they know the best spot on the Lillooet means they've only been there once. Like, honestly, because that the upper Squamish too, it changes quite a bit,
right? Yeah,
the Lillooet's in a wide plain, and I've been to walked into spots where I've been walking with clients and been like, this is okay up here. And then all of a sudden you get there and you're like, what? Okay. Sorry guys. We're back out of here. Cause there's no water.
Yeah.
Like the river changes so much in the upper part. Once you hit Mount Curry and you go down towards Harrison Lake, it's much more consistent. It's good. It's good too, but it's much more consistent.
Now, is there a glass of tightrope at the end of the day? Is there a cold beer? What's that look like?
I'm not when I'm fishing, I'm not really drinking, to be honest. I'm drinking at the end of the day, but yeah, I'm not an alcohol in the boat kind of guy or on my feet kind of fisherman.
Cuts into the fishing too much.
Well, it's something to carry that you don't want to carry, right? And yeah, it's a distraction. You know, I know there's a lot of guys, and especially with ice fishing, there's a lot of philosophy of just sitting there and pounding beers. But for me, that's not how I do it. And I do it after for sure. You know? But not during.
Yeah. Good stuff.
Yeah.
So, if somebody wants to sign up for your wine club or come out to visit you at the winery, what's the best way to get a hold of you guys? Because I know, well, we're coming into busy season, so I'm assuming you're open pretty much throughout the tourist season.
Yeah, we're open full-time right now. We open Easter weekend,
yep,
and we shut Thanksgiving. So we have, like I said, we have Colin. He's a Monday to Friday general manager. He's there all day those days. Andrea is our wine club manager. She's Thursday to Monday, full time. We're guaranteed from noon to four, there's someone in the shop. And Lindsay will be around most days. I'm in and out, you know, because the two other properties are about 5 or 6 kilometers away. But at the end of the day, I will walk in that shop at about 4:45 and grab most of the tasting bottles and take them to my kitchen because I'm about to make dinner.
Oh, we never uncovered that. You like to cook a little bit.
I do like to cook.
Just not rainbow trout, right?
No, not rainbows. If you know, I've always had the, if you're going to eat, might as well be good. And yeah. I do like to cook.
You got some fresh herbs off that kitchen?
We do some fresh rosemary and dill and mint and parsley. One thing about the Okanagan is the sun. Like, you can grow whatever you want.
Yeah.
So those things come inside for the winter. So we have fresh rosemary for sure. Not parsley so much because the humidity is not good enough. But yeah.
Yeah. A little thyme here and there.
Yep. Absolutely.
Yeah. Well, I just got my herb garden going again this year, man. There's nothing better than just going out in the backyard and grabbing something for cooking.
Oh, for sure. Like, it depends if you're having lamb. I like a Dijon mustard with rosemary and garlic in the processor, and smear that all over the lamb, and then
you're making me
give
hungry.
It a quick bake. Oh, dude. Well, tonight, the funny thing is, tonight we had the last of the kokanee.
Ah, yeah.
Tonight was the last of the ice fished kokanee. So now, you know, I made a joke at dinner, like, you got to wait till New Year's now to get more of this. So you better enjoy it.
Grim, thanks so much for coming on the show, man. I really enjoyed chatting with you. I wish you an amazing season on the water, and make sure you're getting a few days off there so you're still chasing some fins.
I get a lot of days off. I get to fish probably more than most people. Not to brag, but I do fish a lot. Thanks for having me.
We've been chatting with Graham O'Rourke. Graham has a Tightrope Winery in Naramata with his wife, Lindsay. Look him up on the Naramata bench in beautiful BC. Thanks for joining us, folks. We'll catch you next time.
The Fly Fishing 97 podcast is brought to you by theflycrate.com. Thank you for listening to the Fly Fishing 97 podcast. Your feedback matters. Let us know if there's a person or topic you'd like discussed. Email us at mark@flyfishing97.com. Until next time, tight lines, and we'll see you on the water.